Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, dialing in from London.
And I'm Michael Moran, calling in from New York City. Welcome to the podcast. This week, we'll talk with Emily Ferris, our analyst for Russia and the former Soviet states, about parliamentary elections in Russia, where Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party is likely to prevail.
Mike, then we'll talk about politics in Jordan, the Levant's most stable country and an important regional ally of the West. Andrew Freeman, our analyst for the Hashemite Kingdom, explains why the upcoming parliamentary election is a source of tension. But first, Mike, let's go to Latin America.
Well, the so-called pink tide of leftist populism moved across the continent in the 1990s and the early 2000s, but in recent years we've seen a number of political setbacks in the left in Latin America, including the most recent one, the impeachment of Brazil's Dilma Rousseff, but also troubles in Argentina and in Venezuela. I spoke with Simon Whistler, our lead Latin American analyst, about the state of the Latin American left.
Simon, you're in Bogota today. You're looking around the region and you see that Venezuela is struggling, and we've just seen Dilma Rousseff at the top of another populist left-leaning government be impeached and leave office. Does this mean that the wave that was so prominent earlier in the century toward populist left-wing governments, has it crested and we're now going into reverse?
I think it's a question of the left being down but not out. You're right to say Venezuela, the leftist government there, is in trouble. Dilma's been impeached in Brazil. The Kirchners have lost power in Argentina, and there have been a number of other electoral setbacks in recent times for leftist governments around the region. But as I say, I mean, I think this reflects in many ways a positive step in the maturing of Latin American democracy. I think in many cases these leftist movements have suffered setbacks precisely because voters are punishing them at the ballot box for economic mismanagement more than anything else, corruption scandals and the like. So in many ways, examples of typical democracies. But I think it's wrong to say that the left is definitely out. And in fact, there's a good argument to say in many cases it's stronger than ever. If you look across the region, the leftist movements that have come to power, you've had populist leaders, but you've had strong leftist movements behind them. And those movements are the ones that over time have the potential, have the strength to help the left retain residual power over time. You've got the Workers' Party in Brazil, Chavismo in Venezuela, Correa's Country First Movement in Ecuador, and a number of others. And these are non-traditional parties now. They're political movements that unite grassroots over issues of social justice, poverty reduction, whether those governments have actually delivered. But I think the important thing here is these are really powerful movements that have suffered setbacks, but they retain a lot of grassroots strength that their opponents, whether on the political right or in the center, have no strong answer to. And that gives them a really strong base to work from in, say, 3, 4, 5 years' time when new electoral cycles come back up.
Simon, you say there's no strong counter-argument, but you've got more open, more liberal-oriented economies like Chile and Colombia and Mexico growing at a decent pace all through this period. Is there no party in Brazil, in Venezuela, et cetera, where we're holding up these other economies in the region as an example of where things might be different?
So I think that's one argument that can be made in terms, again, of how the left is going to retain strength over time, in the sense that actually a lot of these leftist movements, they came to power in terms of proponents of populist economics, resource nationalism and the like. They've adapted over time. Venezuela, I think you can discard as a case unto itself and a real exception to the rule. But you look at Ecuador, you look at Bolivia, you look at someone like Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, the kind of the real bête noire of the U.S. during the Cold War. These are all countries now that seek foreign investment. They seek private investors because they know that a stronger economy brings greater political power. So on one level, yes, the argument can be that kind of liberal economics has taken hold a little bit stronger in the region. But I think if you go back to kind of what these movements are about, kind of the social justice, the fight for better inequality, the fight against the corruption that the right of the past in Latin America has often represented, those are still very strong political arguments. And that's the area where I think kind of the right and the center still struggle to find its real voice against the left.
Well, Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike, thanks. Power dynamics are fairly predictable in Russia, where parliamentary elections on the 18th of September are likely to see Vladimir Putin's party consolidate its power in the State Duma, the lower house of the parliament. Emily Ferris, our associate analyst for Russia and the CIS, tells us more. Emily, the Russian parliamentary elections are September the 18th. In a system essentially dominated by one party, I suppose, we're free to draw our own conclusions about the outcome. But is the election a foregone conclusion?
Well, I'd say that broadly the elections might be a foregone conclusion, and there will inevitably be some comparisons between this election and the previous 2011 and 2012 presidential and parliamentary elections. But actually, they are quite different. And even though I think we are likely to see Putin's United Russia Party gain most of the seats in the Duma, this year's elections are a little more transparent than the previous years. So, for example, we've seen the head of the Electoral Commission replaced with a well-respected human rights ombudsman. And there have been some genuinely independent candidates running this year. The authorities are looking to reduce the scope for public protest this year by making the elections seem to be as fair as possible. And this obviously comes against the backdrop of very serious economic concerns in Russia, which provides scope for some public protests.
Emily, given these efforts towards greater transparency and legitimacy, what kind of nuance can we take away from the election process?
Well, despite the fact that there have been some efforts to increase transparency in this vote, there have actually been a lot more typical examples of efforts to discredit the opposition and to prevent them from campaigning freely. They've been discredited in various corruption scandals, and their rallies have been picketed and disrupted by pro-Kremlin youth groups. There are a few things that I think we can take away, even if we think that the elections are likely to be skewed in United Russia's favour. The first is that there have been several very important rotations of President Putin's staff in the last few months. And these were people who previously had a very close personal relationship with Putin. And they've been replaced with much younger and relatively unknown faces, which indicates that personal relationships aren't really sufficient to keep these individuals in power. And it looks as though Putin has a longer-term view towards the presidential elections in 2018, although he hasn't confirmed that he's going to stand. It is likely that Putin is gathering loyalists around himself, at least to preserve his legacy if he does stand down. And I think the second point that's quite interesting about these elections is that in the run-up to them, there's been increasing grassroots protests, predominantly from blue-collar workers, such as truck drivers and miners and farmers, most of whom are Putin's core supporters. And so I think there is the potential for a more organized challenge to the status quo in the longer term if the economy doesn't pick up.
Emily Ferris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck, thanks. The Kingdom of Jordan has enjoyed decades of stability compared to its neighbors, and in recent years has also enjoyed growth in its tourism sector, direct foreign investments, and trade. Much of this stability is credited to the relative popularity of its Hashemite rulers, and the adeptness with which King Abdullah, the ruling elites, the military police, and others have been able to manage politics, quiet dissent, and limit the political activism of Islamist groups. But parliamentary elections on 20 September raised the possibility of unrest driven by youth members of the Muslim Brotherhood who feel disenfranchised. Andrew Freeman explains.
Andrew, we've got an election coming up that goes back to a former electoral system that Jordan had, a block electoral system rather than a one person, one vote. How would that affect this election, and how does it affect Jordan and the parliament's relationship with the king?
Well, the biggest way that the block party system is going to affect elections is the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an unlicensed and outlawed organization, is going to participate in the elections that it boycotted in 2010 and 2013. The fact that it's a block electoral system means that the Brotherhood can field a much wider range of candidates across a much broader political spectrum, which increases its chances of getting elected. And the Brotherhood itself predicts that it will win something like 20% of the parliamentary seats. Now, should that happen, the government is going to be forced to either accept free and fair elections and therefore a confrontation with the Brotherhood over political reform, for example, issues like the fact that the monarchy can still choose a prime minister rather than parliament. So really, we're looking at a confrontation between those free and fair elections and the government's willingness to accept political reform, particularly if it's coming from a group like the Muslim Brotherhood.
Andrew, Jordan's been notably calm compared to its neighbors. How much of this do you think has to do with the king's ability to let off steam in society through these kinds of elections?
Yeah, parliamentary elections are a good way of blowing off steam, like you say, but they also highlight other problems within Jordan. For example, 30% of all youths are unemployed. Jordan also suffers from an increase in radicalization, particularly after the presence of the Islamic State in Syria and Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, who have also moved across into neighboring Lebanon. On top of that, Jordan has an estimated 600,000 refugees, although the kingdom itself puts that figure nearer 1.4 million. So yes, although the country's managed to stay relatively stable over that period of time, there are certain elements within society that are disenfranchised and are discontented, and I think that these upcoming elections will really show that, particularly among youth movements and the Brotherhood, who have looked to be much more active than in previous elections.
That's great, Andrew. Thank you very much for joining.
Mike, thanks. Before we close out today's podcast, let's talk about a few other issues on our list for the next couple of weeks. Tuesday, the 20th of September, marks the first anniversary of Nepal's new constitution. Travelers should anticipate nationwide demonstrations in protest of the controversial document.
Voters in Nigeria's Edo state are going to the polls on 28 September to choose a new governor, after the election was postponed earlier this month for security reasons. We expect tensions to be high on the polling day.
The 28th of September also marks the one-year anniversary of the Occupy Central pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. Further demonstrations are anticipated to mark the date.
That's it for this edition of the Risk Map podcast. Join us again in 2 weeks for another update on the challenges ahead in the global business environment. Until then, this is Michael Moran from New York. Thanks for clicking in. Talk to you again soon.
And from London, this is Charles Hecker. Thanks, Mike. Bye for now.